So friends, if you gather a group of people together, even a group of people just this size, you'd be hard-pressed to find a single thing about which everybody agrees 100%. And yet, I think I stumbled upon an idea this week, two ideas, in fact, that I think not just everybody here in this room can agree on as Christians, but perhaps all the Christians in the world, all 3 billion of us, the world over. So I just want to run them by you, and you can let me know what you think of these ideas. The first idea is this. If Jesus had a theme song, it would most definitely be a country western song. I will interpret your silence as agreement. That's number one. Number two, my second idea is this. If all the Christians in the world got together to cast their vote, to choose the country western song that would become Jesus' theme song this morning, everyone would have to pick, our hands would be tied, but you have to choose Garth Brooks's Friends in Low Places. Now, if you don't know the song, the title is pretty self-explanatory. It's about a guy who has friends in low places where the whiskey flows and the beer chases his blues away. And it will be okay, or so the song says. So since January, we've been working our way through the Gospel of Luke, and if we've learned anything about Jesus, is that he is a guy who has friends in some pretty low places. Just in our reading last week, in fact, we saw Jesus taking flack from the religious elite of his day for sharing his dinner table with tax collectors and prostitutes and drunks and ne'er-do-wells of all shapes and sizes. Jesus had friends in low places. Garth Brooks had it right, I think. But that's a stark contrast, isn't it, from the rich man that we're presented with in today's story. The rich man decidedly, purposefully, as a matter of habit and practice, only had friends in high places. We're told that every morning he got up and he put on some fine linens and that he wrapped himself in a fine purple robe. Now, that detail doesn't seem like a big deal to you and me because we're used to seeing purple clothing. Kathleen's wearing a purple shirt, as a matter of fact, this morning. Barbara's wearing a purple sweater. Sherry's wearing purple. Purple all the way around. But back in Jesus' day, a purple robe would have been an extravagant, extravagant expense. It turns out that purple dye was made in only one region of the ancient world. It was made in a region called Tyre, which is a little north of Israel. It's on the edge of the Mediterranean Sea. And it was made by extracting, this is kind of gross, the secretions of a certain kind of sea snail. And it turns out to make a single gram of this dye, you had to process 9,000 snails. So needless to say, it is a time-consuming thing. It's a labor-intensive process. So purple dye and the garments that they were used to make were an extraordinary expense. There's actually the story from the 3rd century. There was a Roman emperor by the name of Aurelian, and his wife wanted to purchase a purple shawl for herself. But he wouldn't let her buy it because, in his own words, that shawl is literally, actually worth its weight in gold. So when Jesus says that this man had a purple robe that he wore every day, it means that he was rich, rich. He's not just upper middle class. He's like Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg kind of rich. But sitting at this rich man's gate, there is a not-so-rich man by the name of Lazarus. He's covered in sores, and he is in rough, rough shape. Jesus includes a somewhat grotesque detail. He says that the neighborhood dogs would come and lick at his open sores, lick their oozing pus and blood. Thanks for that image, Jesus. That's pretty gross. Lazarus is in rough shape, and all he asks from this rich man is for just scraps off of his table. The story doesn't say it explicitly, but it's implied in the story that this rich man never gave Lazarus so much as a grain of rice. And again, it's not spelled out in the story, but it certainly sounds as if every time this rich man left his house, he would walk around Lazarus, or he would step over Lazarus, as though he were some sort of object, or some sort of thing, really. But back in just 2012, actually, there was a study done by two neuroscientists, one from Duke, one from Princeton. They got together to do a study about how the human mind perceives things around it. And I think their findings were equal parts fascinating and distressing. So what they found is that if you imagine that your mind is like a radar, like you'd find on a submarine or on a ship, as you're walking through the world, different things will blip on your radar in different colors. So when you're walking and you pass a microphone or a pew or an organ, inanimate objects, things, it's going to blip in one color. Let's say red. But as you're walking through the world and you see a human being, it's going to blip in another color. Let's say red. Now, what these researchers found is that when you're walking through the streets and you see someone who is obviously homeless, maybe someone who is in front of the CVS on a flipped over milk crate with a Dunkin' Donuts cup in their hand asking for change, maybe it's someone over there at the intersection of Mass Ave and the Alewife Brook Parkway, someone with a raggedy cardboard sign saying that they're a vet asking for money. The study found that when you see a person who is obviously homeless, they don't blip on the radar of your mind as a person. They don't show up red on your radar. Your mind perceives them as an inanimate object. Your mind perceives them as you would a trash can or a post office box or a street light. They come up blue on the radar of your mind. We perceive homeless people as objects or things. I think we see that play out in pretty spectacular detail in the rest of today's story. Because the next thing Jesus does, he kills off both of the characters in the story. Lazarus ends up going to heaven. He's sitting at a great banquet table with Abraham, who is one of the great patriarchs of the Jewish religion. The rich man finds his way down to hell, where he's being burnt by the hellfire. He's in torment. He's in pain. And the rich man looks up to heaven, and he sees Lazarus, and he sees Abraham, and he speaks to them, but he doesn't speak to Lazarus. He speaks to Abraham, and he says, "Abraham, would you send Lazarus down from heaven into hell with me that he can dip his finger in water and put a drop of it on my tongue that I may be soothed?" Abraham thankfully says, "No way." And then he says, "In fact, a great chasm has been fixed between the two of us. We can't get to you. You can't get to us." That doesn't seem to stop the rich man. He pivots a little and says, "Well, if you want to send Lazarus to me, at least send Lazarus to my family to warn them that they need to change their ways, that they need to start being nicer to people, that they don't end up in the same torment I'm in." Again, Abraham rebuffs him. He says, "Well, you know, if your family hasn't listened to what's clearly laid out in the Old Testament, in Moses and the prophets, nothing's really going to change your ways." So the answer is no. What we find is that even in death, even as this rich man is looking up at Lazarus, who has found his way to heaven, who is sitting at a banquet table with none other than Abraham, he's still thinking about him like he's an object, like he's property, like he's some sort of slave that can be ordered around for his own benefit. He can't see Lazarus as a real, living, breathing human being. He can't get there. So I want to suggest to us this morning is that the chasm of which Abraham speaks, this chasm fixed between us and the poor, those at need, those who don't have it as well off as us, that chasm is real. And it's something that we can't cross after we die. So it's something that we have to cross while we're still living and breathing. We have to do something to cross that divide, to bridge that chasm now. Now, you don't have to be crazy like Larry, who spends, I think, 11 and a half out of 12 months of the year volunteering at different places around the U.S., helping people fix up their homes. You don't have to be like David in our congregation, who must spend 30 hours a week washing trays and dishes for various soup kitchens in the area. You don't have to be like Barbara, who spends every Friday offering hospitality to homeless folks at the Friday Cafe. You don't have to go be crazy about it. But if we are who we say we are, followers of Jesus, we need to follow Jesus in going out and rubbing shoulders with people in some low places. Now, I don't know what that's going to look like for your own life. If that means when you're rushing into CVS to fill a pharmacy order, maybe you're going to just take 5 minutes and get to know that person who's asking for change at the door. Maybe you're going to volunteer at a soup kitchen once in a while. What I'm asking you not to do is be the person who stops on the Alewife Brook Parkway to talk to folks, because I'm going to be behind you honking and screaming at you, wondering what the holdup is. So don't do that. But Jesus calls us to actually, for Christ's sake, actually get out and do something and meet people. Now, this is going to sound a little more provocative than it actually is, but I often tell volunteers at the outdoor church that the moment that you come to dislike a homeless person because of their personality, whether it's because they tell off-color jokes, or whether it's because they're rude, or whether it's because they always talk about themselves and never ask you how your day is going, for whatever reason it is, the moment that you can admit to yourself that you don't like a homeless person because of their personality, that is a good thing, because you finally accepted them as a human being, flaws and all. They're no longer an object of your hate. They're no longer an object of your charity. They're just another human being. So friends, I simply invite you to follow Jesus, and let's go out and make us some friends in low places. Amen.